Chicago activist Andrew Holmes, WTTW's Jeffrey Bayer, and local author Dave Reedy. And now, here's your host, a man who is using Cyber Monday to stock up on flip-flops and swimwear, Justin Kaufman.
You're the fool. You should do that. You're the fool. Think about how expensive flip-flops are going to be in March. Not me. I get my Speedos now. On sale, 30% off. That's right. I'm taking advantage of my Cyber Monday. Good evening, everybody. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. I may have fibbed a little bit. I didn't actually buy any flip-flops or swimwear today. I just want to make a quick disclaimer right at the top. That was not something I did. But it would be something I thought about. It's definitely something I thought about. I've got a great show to welcome you back to the life of the real. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving and that you're ready for the final day of November. We're going to help you through that tonight. We've got an outstanding show for the first day back. WTTW's Jeffrey Bayer is here. He's got a new television special touring parts of Chicago, this time the South Side. That's right. He and his producer put a new special together, crisscrossing different neighborhoods and giving us the ultimate history lessons. Can't wait to watch. And our guest tonight at the big table, Chicago gun violence activist Andrew Holmes. Holmes has dedicated his life to supporting the South Side and victims of gun violence. He knows it very well. When he was shot at the age of 25, it took him months to learn to walk again. And then just in the last couple years, he lost a child, a daughter, from a shooting. We'll talk to him about his life on the streets, helping people, and what it takes to do that job, which is a tremendous job dealing with victims of gun violence every single day. And some arts and culture for you tonight. Chicago author Dave Reedy just put out his first novel, The Voiceover Artist. It's getting rave reviews. Dave's hot. We'll talk. He'll be here after 9 o'clock. And in sports, the feel-good story of the year, Wendell Phillips. Phillips High School has done something that nobody else has ever done. That's right. They're the first public league football team to win a state championship. We'll talk with the coach a little bit later in the show. And, of course, the Bulls are playing the Spurs tonight. So we got a fan jam lined up, all that, plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Eric Solomon, and production, of course, provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download. All right, you know what? I think we start the show the way we start every show, with the carry out. Of course, this is where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Guns, guns, and more guns. Whether it's an attack on a Colorado Planned Parenthood, canceling classes at UFC, or locking down a school in Barrington, guns are the story of the day. Again, that being said, it is Cyber Monday, so pretty good deals can be had on semi-automatics. All kidding aside, maybe we should do something about this. Okay, no, never mind. Sorry, I brought it up. The University of Chicago canceled all classes today after the FBI told them of a serious threat that could have been a mass shooting. The threat turned out to be a UIC student who commented on World Star Hip Hop. Not necessarily your ISIS common thread, but whatever. Eric Zorn from The Trib points out today that most mass shooters in recent memory don't announce their intentions. They just do it. So glad they canceled classes, but surprised the FBI didn't do some Google searches beforehand. Right? Reverend Jesse Jackson says he's going to up the intensity of protests over the police shooting of Laquan McDonald. So more drums, more staring point blank at riot cops. Oh, more people. Weekend protests were not very well attended. That being said, they did show college football on Friday this weekend, so it did mess up everybody's clock. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle called for the ousting of both Anita Alvarez and Gary McCarthy. And Chewy Garcia's back just in time to say, hey, this wouldn't have happened if you'd have voted for me. Well, maybe. I mean, I would have factored in. I mean, yeah, it would have. Alvarez says she's not apologizing for the length of the investigation, saying she did it in part to get the feds involved. When asked for comment, the feds said, Anita who? And then they slammed the door like in a cartoon and the house fell down and the truck took off. And then Popeye was just, oh, God, where's that player going? Or whatever cartoon is your favorite. Governor Bruce Rauner got some great ink today in the New York Times, essentially telling Illinois residents what we already knew. Rauner's rich and has really rich buddies who are continuing to put money into his campaign. For not just new Christmas sweaters, but for the upcoming legislative election in 2016. That's right, folks. Who needs a budget compromise when you can just change the lawmakers? And that's your political lesson for today. Tomorrow, how much is too much when it comes to a bribe? Meanwhile, the state is suing prisoners after their release to recoup room and board costs. Nothing says welcome back to society more than a $20,000 lawsuit. Chicago Teachers Union is taking a strike vote on December 9th. No word if the vote will use Common Core standards. Do you want to strike? Yes or no? Plus 7 equals 10 divided by an adjective. Show your gobbledygunk. Target's website went down today from the flood of Cyber Monday traffic. The webmasters blamed the crash on their virtual Black Friday video game that allows you to beat up other avatars online, for that fondue said. And now it's time for the Downloads Facebook report. Star Wars is coming out, and some of my friends are seriously excited. Also, Amy Schumer got naked for a calendar. Take that, trolls. And former Chicago White Sox pitcher Richard Dotson was suggested as someone I should be friends with. Huh. Well, that's the Downloads Facebook report. The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 won the Thanksgiving weekend, beating out the Rocky sequel Creed, not only in length of title, but in box office numbers. I knew they were making a mistake by not having Rocky fight a boxer from ISIS. Death to Philadelphia!
Death to Philadelphia!
I realized when I was just doing that joke that I turned into, like, Joe Cocker. My whole body just, like, spread out.
With a little help from my friends!
Okay, all right, back to it. In weather, it's November 30th. What do you think the weather's like? In sports, the Bears have a little swagger after beating the Pack on Thanksgiving, 5-6 with 5 winnable games to play. They got San Francisco, Washington, Detroit, Tampa, and Minnesota left. It is the Bears, so 1-4 is not out of the question. It was great, though, to watch the Bears beat the Pack during all that Favre hoopla. It was just the worst listening to the Brett Favre stories while Bears were pulling the upset. Nice play by the defense. The Bears look like they're gonna win, but Brett, how do those Wranglers fit so snug? You're perfect. That was my Chris Collinsworth right there. Guy's got such big teeth. The Bulls are back home tonight against the 14-3 Spurs. Early NBA final matchup? Well, if LeBron, Kyrie Irving, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and all the Toronto Raptors tried to scale Mount Everest together and die in an avalanche, then yeah. Could possibly be an NBA Finals matchup. Tonight, the ACC Big Ten Challenge begins in college basketball. Northwestern Illinois players will have a lot of fun watching Michigan State play Duke later in the tournament. And finally, that one story is back where someone tallies up how much it would cost to give someone the gifts mentioned in the 12 Days of Christmas. This year, taking into account inflation, $34,000. Maybe they should just change the lyrics once and for all. On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a $10 gift card to Chili's. All right, that's the carryout for November 30th, 2015. Enjoy the leftover special. We put some soggy green bean casserole in there for you. Because, well, we got to get rid of it. More to come this hour. Jeffrey Bear stops by to talk about his new special on Chicago Southside. Hopefully I can get my impression going on Jeffrey Bear as we move along the lakefront. It's a download here on WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Jeffrey Bear is going to be here to talk about his new show, Chicago Southside. Of course, you know Jeffrey's work on Channel 11. He did Chicago by L. He did Chicago Downtown by Boat. Remember, these are all the documentaries. Like, as we move to the left, take a look down here. Yeah, it doesn't precede, but it precedes in popularity, maybe, the boat tours here in Chicago. But he did that. He's done everything, and he's turning his attention to Chicago's South Side as we go down King Drive. With really cool, like, public TV music behind it. Boom, 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 boom. Really cool. Well, okay, so you know what? It's almost December, and that means that we should have a check-in here on the download for the Chicago Blackhawks. There's no doubt about it. Tomorrow night, they return home to the United Center after the West Coast trip, the circus trip, if you will. They play the Minnesota Wild tomorrow. You know, the Blackhawks look good. They lost a heartbreaker against the Kings over the weekend. I think it was Saturday, right? Maybe it was yesterday. Anyway.
And, you know, for us at the Download, we're always like sort of the stepchild when it comes to coverage because we don't have the Eddie Olchicks or the coach. Coach Q checks in with Cochran in the morning. It just seems like the Blackhawks give a lot of, you know, the star analysts to the other programs, and rightfully so, that their prime time, their drive time, that kind of thing. So we've kind of been out on our own. And luckily, we've had one analyst who's always helped us out, Javi Havivola. Javi, of course, played with the Blackhawks back. He had a real quick stretch in 2001, 2002. Came back to the team, I think, in 2004, 2005. Bounced around. You know, he's from Latvia. But he has agreed to be the Download's hockey analyst. We had a rough time with him in the playoffs last year because he just wasn't always on point. But he's learned. We sent him to the Barry Melrose Training Center, which is out in Connecticut. And then he also spent some time with Chris Chelios, some one-on-one sessions, mostly about extreme sports. But we thought, you know, hey, we'll pay for that. Javi Havivola, welcome back to the Download. How are you, bud?
Thank you, Justin. Great to be here. Great to be back on the Download. Really, really good.
Top shape. All right, good. Well, we're excited to have you here, Javi. We're going to give you another shot. What do we make of the Hawks so far as the season begins?
Yeah, with the goal and an assist in Saturday's loss in Los Angeles, you know, Patrick Kane is the real story of the day. He scored a point in 19 successive games for Chicago Blackhawks. But the all-time lead record Kane, you know, is still chasing is the Canadian Golden Goose Wayne Gretzky. He appeared on the score sheet in the incredible 51 consecutive games, Justin. Even if Gretzky never scored a single goal, he had more career assists than any other player has total points. So Kane still has work to do, but he's looking really good so far.
Yeah, wow, that's great. That's all right. Well, what impact does, you know, you played the game. What impact does the West Coast trip have on the team?
Yeah, many games. You know, flying on planes isn't easy for Midwestern teams, but Justin, they're skating faster, pushing the blue line, hammering the boards, and getting shots in the basket. 2 points a basket.
What do you mean basket? Goal, the net, right?
No, hold on the phone. Hold the phone, please. Hold the phone.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. You know what? It's not even an issue. Just shake it. It's goal, basket, doesn't really matter. What can we see from the team moving forward here, especially in December, January months?
There is a team of hockey-playing Roman Catholic priests called the Flying Fathers. They only play exhibition games to raise money for charities.
Okay, no, that doesn't have anything to do with the Blackhawks. I let's get back. We had it. You were right out. You were doing some outstanding analysts. You know, so just get back on. What can we see from the Blackhawks?
Planning to spend Christmas in beautiful United Kingdom, traveling over the holidays can be notoriously busy, expensive, and stressful. But the news isn't all bad. Catch a breeze with cut-rate FL deals on flight.
Yeah, we almost had him. Javi Havivola, the former Blackhawk and now the Download's analyst. Almost had it, Pete. He sounded good, and I thought we might have had something new, but got flustered with the basket and lost it. Maybe next time. It's a Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, things are looking up, Chicago. Why? Well, because my next guests have produced some new work for Channel 11. That's right. Jeffrey Bear and producer Eddie Griffin have teamed up for the television tour called Chicago's South Side. You know Jeffrey's work, Chicago by L, Chicago's Lakefront, the Boulevards by Bike, Chicago by Boat. I'm hoping for Chicago by Hovercraft.
Or Drone.
A drone would be good. Jeffrey Bear and Eddie Griffin, thanks for being here. Good to see you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
I was thinking about this. I'm like, okay, so you kind of already covered Southside a little bit because you did Chicago by L, and that was neighborhoods. But what's
biking the boulevards.
And biking the boulevards. So what's the difference here when you do Chicago by Southside? What are you doing in this one that's different than the others?
Well, we've never done a show, and Jeffrey's never done a show, where it's just focusing on the South Side. You know, so biking the boulevards, you know, cut a path and cut around and the L, you know, follow the L path. But we're doing neighborhoods. This is all about the neighborhoods. And, you know, there's maybe 28 or so that we got through.
Eddie counted them all.
Yeah, I did on the way in, and I was trying to make sure that we got them all in. But, of course, you know.
A long time ago, Jeffrey gave up counting.
Believe me.
It was done by Chicago by L. He's like, listen, new contract, I don't count.
Well, and so to sort of focus it down, we focus it around eight featured neighborhoods, sort of the eight big ones. K Can you name them, Eddie? It's like naming the reindeer.
Beverly, yeah. Bridgeport, Chinatown, Englewood.
That's four.
We call it the Southeast Side, which is really South Chicago East Side, South Deering and Hegwisch.
Oh my God.
We've also got
Pullman.
And
Chinatown, did you say?
Yes, in Chinatown, yeah, I should say.
See, this is what happens. Do Chinatown twice.
You said Beverly, you said Bridgeport.
They say Bronzeville.
Bronzeville.
Did I get a Bronzeville?
All the bees.
There you go.
So Englewood.
You got Englewood. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
did
for
I say
all
Englewood?
These neighborhoods, these are, I mean, this is an interesting tour because Chicago with the Stockyards and the Chicago South Side, there's a ton of tradition, there's a ton of history. I've just on my own, just as an amateur, gone to different places being like, oh, that's the first blah 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 in the entire country. Oh, this is unbelievable to see this place is still standing. This is like Chicago history. So the South Side has a tremendous amount of history that a lot of people never see.
Yeah, well, Chicago settled from the South. I mean, if you think about it, in the days, like the early days, you had to come around the bottom of the lake to get into Chicago. So all this, and then you would have had to cross the river to go to the north, right? So all the settlement kind of piled up on the south side. The first Gold Coast of Chicago was on the south side. All the big industrial developments, you know, it all started on the south side of Chicago. The other thing that Eddie and I were talking about before is, you know, people say they're from the south side, right? Like I'll confess it, I'm a north side guy. I've lived on the north side all my life. I love the north side, right? But it's not like my identity.
Right.
Right. Eddie is from?
I'm from Beverly. I'm a Southsider, which means I have a lot of people to answer to if we get any of this wrong. But, you know, very often it comes out. And I don't know if that's because, you know, us being WTTW and other television stations and stuff are, you know, either in the loop or north side. So it's, we don't cover the south side as much because of just logistics. I mean, it takes a long time
to
get down
there. There's a lot of that,
yeah. We had to build overtime into our budget.
We did.
Literally did. Because it takes a long time to
get
to these
locations. And then
went
over that a little bit.
Well, Jeffrey, I mean, you from your travels and doing all the different documentaries I mentioned earlier, you've learned a lot about Chicago, not just the north side, but the south side. Were there things in this one that you're like, oh, I had no idea that I didn't even know.
No,
we're
I know everything.
You know everything.
I know everything there is to know. That to me, that's the joy and what I love most about my work is when people come up, they say, you know, I've lived there all my life and I never knew that, you know, and I love that. I love discovering. You know, there's some things in the show that I had known about from other shows, but when I first, you know, learned about them, blew my mind. You know, Meyer's Ace Hardware in Bronzeville used to be this big jazz club in the era of the Stroll and the Black Metropolis. And if you go in there and you go in the manager's office, that was the stage, and the backdrop is still painted on the wall. This sort
cool.
of Afrocentric kind of almost like it's kind of weird. It's almost like Afro-Cuban would be very not PC today, you know, like natives beating on bongos. But this was like the backdrop for Louis Armstrong and Earl Father Hines and all these people who played in this club, you know, and it's now an Ace Hardware store.
Now, Eddie, you grew up in Beverly. Were there things, you know, researching and putting this together that you didn't know about your own neighborhood?
Yeah. So specifically in Beverly, there's a kind of a newer microbrew pub, Horse Thief Hollow. And it opened probably 2 or 3 years ago, something like that. The name comes from, you know, down there, the Beverly Ridge, the historic ridge was, you know, kind of a you know, even a prehistoric island.
It's the highest point in Chicago.
Right.
Highest elevation.
And horse thieves used to steal horses and they would hide them in the ravine. And so, you know, that it was, you know, similar or around where the restaurant is now was once like a horse thief trading place.
The horses that you stole, that's mm-hmm. where you put them. This is great. If you've not seen any of the Channel 11 WTTW documentaries that Jeffrey and Eddie have been a part of, you got to check them out. I mean, they're some of the greatest television. And I've said this to you before, Jeffrey. This is some of the greatest television produced here ever.
Well, thank you.
Ever.
Thank you.
And
actually, you can see all these shows if you go on our website, WTTW.com/Jeffrey Bear. It's spelled funny, GeoffreyBaer. But if you can find your way there, you know, you can see them online.
Jeffrey Bear and producer Eddie Griffin in studio talking about Chicago by Southside, which will be airing tonight on Channel 11 at 10 o'clock. We'll be right back.
Come on from the south, 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 south,
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight, Jeffrey Bear, Eddie Griffin. They got a new television tour for WTTW. It's all about the South Side. We talked a little bit about the unique things in Bronzeville and Beverly. One of my favorite areas of the South Side is the Southeast Side. When you start going down to Calumet, Fisheries, and that area, and it's just unbelievable the history that's in that area. How much are you guys focusing on that area as part of the documentary?
Well, it's one of our major segments. We go down, we interview Dan Lira, who's with the South Chicago Chamber of Commerce, and Jeffrey interviews him on the site of the old U.S. Steel Southworks plant.
Completely cleared site, except these huge, like 30, 40-foot high concrete walls that run for like thousands of feet that were just too big to tear down.
Yeah, I mean, if you think Chicago is the third largest city in the country, we've got a ton of undeveloped room down there. I mean, of course, it was, you know, there was four or five steel factories down there. But it's like you're 10 minutes from the loop, but it's basically a wilderness now.
Well, you see that in the economic development plans of the mayor and some of the aldermen, especially down in that area, 10th Ward, just talking about Pullman, talking about that area, mm-hmm. developing it, making it mixed use, making it housing.
Well, this plot of land where U.S. Steel Southworks used to be is larger than the loop. It's a bigger parcel than the loop. It's going to take 30 to 40 years to develop it, but we have this aerial shot of their rendering. You know, it's right on the lakefront, marinas.
It's a whole new city.
Yeah.
I mean, in 40 years, you're going to be like, I guess it'll be East Chicago. Well, there is an East Chicago, but
yeah.
Chicago
well,
East.
I mean, but of course, these things all depend on the economy. That plan was in place 12 years ago when I did the South Suburbs show for Channel 11, and we showed aerial photos. It was a different developer at that time. So, you know, we'll see. But at least now they've run Lakeshore Drive down there. They've built a park along the lake. There's a sign that says the Marianos is going in there, you know. These are the things that you have to sort of see, you know, as the economy changes, maybe these things can happen.
You know, the Chicago's always been called the city of neighborhoods, and these neighborhoods have all their historic stories. What I always love about your work is that you show then and now. Chinatown's a good example. I think of Canaryville, Bridgeport, Bronzeville, too. A lot of what's happening now are almost in stark contrast to the history of those neighborhoods. They're not the same.
Right. And, you know, if we just did a historical documentary and aired it today, you know, a lot of the histories of the neighborhoods and the people who live there, you know, like you're saying, it wouldn't be their history. You know, so we would do, you know, the segment on Inglewood. It would not be anything like the people who live there now. So what I love about this show is that we get to, yes, we show you the important, you know, events and historical things that happen, but also show you what life is like now in the neighborhoods and get to meet some people who live there now and who are, you know, living their lives today.
Well, you know, logistically, as you mentioned, it is difficult for people who live on the north side, maybe in some of the suburban collar counties, to get into the south side. It's a little bit more of a haul. You know, for you, Jeffrey, being a North Sider, how often did you, before working this, did you get to the South Side? Did you go down and explore some of these neighborhoods?
Well, the other thing that's interesting is I, like so many people in Chicago, have family history on the South Side, right? I come from a Jewish family. A lot of Jews come from South Shore. My dad came from South Shore and went to Hyde Park High. So when I was a kid, go down, visit Grandma Bear. She lived on 55th Street, you know, in one of those great old residential hotels that became apartment buildings along the lakefront. I think hers was called the Park Shore. But, you know, there was the Sherry, the Powhatan. So I did actually, and I think many people like me, my mom was a West Sider. She grew up in Austin. So and when I was a kid, one set of grandparents lived in Austin, another grandparents lived in Hyde Park. And of course, everyone as a kid, everyone went to the Museum of Science and Industry, didn't matter where you were from, you know. But another thing Eddie and I were talking about beforehand was that these neighborhoods are very balkanized. So like Eddie growing up in Beverly, you maybe never went 10 blocks west to another neighborhood, right?
Right. Spending the summer shooting in these neighborhoods, there were, you know, places that we were 5 minutes from where I grew up that, like, I had never been there. You know, and I have to admit, I didn't know where Pullman was, you know, growing up. Like, it was
never
on our radar.
Isn't that interesting? Because how long would that have taken you to get from your house?
It's like a five-minute ride. You know, I could have got there on my bike in 10 or something.
You're 12 years old in Beverly. You're not thinking about, I'm going to go explore all the neighborhoods of Chicago. That's, yeah, right. I grew up in Wonder Lake, Illinois, and I didn't go to Marengo. 20 minutes over. One of the big elements of the south side of Chicago is the African-American community. That, of course, the west side, too. But in the south side, that's premier. You're talking about Englewood. You're talking about Bronzeville. You're talking about a lot of neighborhoods, Auburn, Gresham, Chatham. Neighborhoods that I don't want to say are forgotten, because that's disrespectful in some ways. But they're neighborhoods that maybe get identified in the current news because of some of the socioeconomic problems, violence being one of them. When you guys are looking at neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago that are predominantly African American, what's the takeaway? I mean, are you looking at the vast history of it and also showing us how it got to the point where they're at now?
I want Eddie to address this, but one of the things I want to say before that is, with all of these shows that I've done on WTTW, people immediately assume that what we want to do is this big sort of gushy Valentine to these neighborhoods. And the actual reality is that that would be intensely boring, even for people who live there. People want to know the real story. That's what's interesting. So we don't shy away from acknowledging what goes on. But why don't you take it from there?
You know, we have to acknowledge what goes on, but we don't dwell on it. And we're not saying it doesn't exist. And it's, you know, it's, we don't have, you know, the capability to really, you know, cover everything.
Yeah, and it's not a documentary on current events. That's not what you're doing either.
But for example, Rashana Baldwin, who right. we've, yeah. Eddie picked this woman, Rashana Baldwin, whom we feature in Bronzeville and talk about her.
Yeah, she does a radio segment on WKKC, What's Good in Englewood.
Yeah.
And she was someone perfect for us because she lives there. She's trying to create, you know, what she does is she tells story, you know, good stories about what's going on and you know, points out to events or, you know, different community organizations in the neighborhood. And she's someone who is, you know, kind of grassroots. I mean, she kind of does all the stuff on her own and, you know, in a sense gives a tour of Englewood to the people who live there who, you know, she says, like, you know, people come up to me and say, oh, I never knew, you know, we had this restaurant or I never knew this organization was available. And she, you know, is like, well, here it is. And I'm telling you it's there. So she was someone who's like, this is, yeah, she's not trying to, you know, tell everyone that the crime and stuff doesn't exist, yeah. But she's trying to, you know, show some good. And that's kind of what we're doing too. We're not saying it doesn't exist. We're not attempting to solve it or come up with an answer for it. We just want to say, hey, there's also other things out there.
Eddie, I got to ask you before we go, from editing and producing and putting this together, do you got a good Jeffrey Bear impression at this point?
I've got a little bin called Outtakes. And I'll just, you know, that might be on the DVD special or maybe the WTTW Christmas party reel. But, you know, I real quickly, I'll just say that we record voiceover in Jeffrey's stand-ups and I hear him all day long. So I'll have a little conversation with him sometimes.
That's how many times do we hear? Moving south. Do we get a lot of that?
I try to avoid cliche wherever possible.
Jeffrey Bear, Eddie Griffin, good to see you guys. Looking forward to this and also Chicago by drone, Chicago
Thank
by
you.
Hovercraft.
Mm-hmm.
Hovercraft would be good too. We should do, you should do Chicago by duck boat. You know, and that would be good.
Absolutely.
There's so many things you
the small personal submarine.
Good to see you guys.
Thanks
for coming
Justin.
In.
Sure thing.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my guest tonight at the big table, Andrew Holmes. Andrew Holmes is a longtime Chicago activist and now a crisis responder. Holmes is one of the few members of Chicago Survivors, a new program sponsored by the city to help victims and victims' families of gun violence. Holmes, no stranger to violence. He was shot when he was 25 years old, and he lost an adult daughter to gun violence last summer in Indianapolis. Andrew Holmes is a fixture at crime scenes, rallies, hospitals, and unfortunately, funerals. He's become one of the South Side's leading spokespersons when it comes to continuing violence and the epidemic here in Chicago. Andrew Holmes, welcome to The Download.
Thank you, sir.
Nice to meet you. I see you quoted all the time. I see you in the news. You really, when I say you kind of become a spokesperson, you have.
Well, I just try to enhance the quality of life of an individual and even try to save the next soul that I can save.
Why? I mean, why this calling?
Well, you know, as you stated, I've been a victim of gun violence before. It took me a couple of months to learn how to re-walk again. And from there, I just had, you know, that feeling about helping other people. You know, I know the feeling you go through when you're in that hospital through all of the surgery and the therapy that you have to learn to live and fight to live. And I wouldn't want nobody to go through that pain. It's just unfortunate now we're in a city that our youth and adults are losing their life to gun battles, to gun violence. So I'm one of the few that survived.
You grew up here in Chicago.
Yes, sir.
Give us an understanding, because I think a lot of people don't really have a clear picture of how violence has evolved over the years. When we see police numbers, they say violence is down. Gun violence is down from what it was like in the 80s or early 90s. From your vantage point, has violence decreased in Chicago?
And on some days and some months, it's decreased. But other months, it's an increase, because you turn around and you see our young children and adults, you know, victims of gun violence, and they lost their life. So, you know, it's an up and down situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Tyshawn Lee, the 9-year-old who was killed. You were out in front of that. You were at the rally that was in the park. You were at his funeral. You know, I mean, obviously the city of Chicago is paying very close attention to the death of Tyshawn Lee, the 9-year-old. There's so many different elements of this story that have come out in the newspaper, and so many comments and people talking about it. When you see this, when you see this happen, it's not the first time it's happened. But when you see it, Andrew Holmes, when you see it, what's your reaction to it?
It's very disturbing, very upset. You know, it's just like a person's heart get to beating and beating faster and faster, and you wondering, well, who's going to step up to the plate and who's going to be the next victim?
This case, as horrific as it is, has brought attention to the epidemic of gun violence in Chicago. You've seen a lot of people become, I don't want to say desensitized to it, but the mainstream Chicago, maybe some of the WGN listeners who are listening in the suburbs, they just see numbers. They see this many shot, this many killed. They're not putting faces to the people. Tyshawn Lee, at 9 years old, got everybody's attention. Is that a good thing?
In a way, it's the worst thing to me, because I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody. But when you look at it far as a good thing, it has to be highlighted nationally and bring some attention to the United States to let them know that this could happen to anybody. I mean, the kid only been here 9 years, but it took his mother 9 months to deliver him. So why cut his life short and execute him like that?
Talking with Andrew Holmes, a Chicago activist, also a crisis responder with Chicago Survivors. And we're going to talk about Chicago Survivors after the break. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, Andrew Holmes, longtime Chicago activist. You've got a day named after you, or a day from the city of Chicago, proclamation. You're also now a crisis responder with Chicago Survivors, which is a program that is being sponsored by the city of Chicago. It's a 2-year sponsorship. Talk about Chicago Survivors and why it's important and why you're involved in it.
Well, just dedication to the people who become victims of gun violence, because when they lose that loved one, that voice is there no more. But at the same time, they need help and they need direction, and they need some people that's going to care. Because when the lights and cameras are gone, we're not gone. We be with them throughout the funeral process. We get them help and try to get funding for the funeral. If we have to relocate them, we'll relocate them. But most important, we try to talk to them families and get to the next kin, young man or young girl who maybe want to retaliate, and we try to encourage them, you know, just stay in school. You only would hurt your family or hurt somebody else's family, but we try to get counseling for the family, and it's very well needed.
Is that one of the big kids? I mean, obviously grief, I mean, the loss of a loved one, a family member, but there also has to, and in a lot of these situations, is this idea of revenge, this idea of retaliation. So you, for the Chicago Survivors, you deal with that as well?
We have a coordinated there that works with youth. So instead of letting a youth just sit there and think about retaliation, Charlene Davis is doing a wonderful job there with the youth, bringing all of the youth together who are suffering because their brothers and sisters are gone. So we try to relax their mind and try to keep their mind on education and let them know that they can do something better with their hands, even if we have to put them back in church, bring them back around the table to eat with their family, where so many families don't even eat around the table anymore.
And get an idea of a crisis responder. I mean, are you listening to the radio? How does it work when there's a crime, especially gun violence? When do you get involved?
We are dispatched out through CPIC. Mm-hmm. And once there's a homicide, we have to either go to the hospital or either the medical examiner's office or wherever this crime scene is at and meet this family to try to maybe defuse the situation if it is there, to let the Chicago Police Department, the detectives, do their job. Once we're there, we follow the protocols and let the family know there's a process that they have to go through. The reason the body is laying out here so long, the next step is going to be to the medical examiner's office. So we go from A to Z and explain to them every process that's going on, because at that time, they're so traumatized, they want to run through that tape. They want to get to their loved ones.
Right.
And we respect that. But once we get there and talk to those parents, the mother, father, they're grieving so much. And, I mean, we can't just look at them and say, you know, well, it ain't right. It ain't right. No, we have to let them vent. We have to let them know we are there for them. We are there to help them. And it's working. It is working because it's very well needed, because someone has to be neutral to let the family know that you do have people here that can help. We understand. We are in these same shoes. We have lost our loved ones. So the next step from here is they're going to remove the remains to the medical examiner's office. And the time that you can go to the medical examiner's office, from the medical examiner's office, the process to the funeral home, from the funeral home, the next step from there.
What's your relationship like with the Chicago Police Department? Because as you said, I mean, they're putting up the yellow tape. They're trying to deal with the beginnings of a homicide investigation. And in some cases, they do have to deal with the family that doesn't want to let go because they're grieving, because they want to get to, as gruesome as it is, the body that's on the street. What's your relationship like with the police?
I've been having a nice, good relationship with the Chicago Police Department, whether it's in the city and out the city. We understand we have mutual goals to meet. And in many, many cases, Chicago Police Department are been disrespected so much on the crime scene when they're only there to help. They're only there to get the evidence. They're only there to get the information so they can make an arrest. But sometimes they point the finger at the police department. I have to tell them sometime when I'm there, no. Let's stop. They're only here to help. They want you to stay back because somebody may have left some evidence that can lead to the person that done killed your loved one. They're human just like we're human, and they hurt just like we hurt. I done seen so many detectives and police officers, they have to take a walk. They have to wipe their eyes because someone loved one is laying down there. Someone loved one is dead. So they care.
There is obviously a perception, and we hear about it a lot in the media, about the relationship between the community and the police. What, from you being on the ground level, is it, what's the relationship like? I mean, does the community trust the police department when the police department shows up and puts up the yellow tape? Are they respecting the process, as you're saying?
Yeah, a lot of them are respecting the process. And then on the other hand, you have a lot of them that don't respect the process. I can understand, you know, that's your brother, that's your sister, that's your loved one. And at that time, they can't believe that the loved one is laying there that long. But it's still a process that they have to go through. And we've asked them so much, you know, work with the Chicago Police Department. Within any job in the city of Chicago, of course, we may have a bad apple here, a bad apple there, but they're weeding out their bad apples on their job just as any other job.
Let me ask you this, because one of the editorials that came off the Tyshawn Lee killing, the 9-year-old, was that the South, where's the protest? Where's the anger? Where's the rage? Where's the organization, the rally to get justice and to right the wrong in the Southside community when something like that happens? Because there was an editorial, a cartoon that came out and said there's always a hashtag Black Lives Matter protest downtown, but you're not seeing anything about, you know, Tyshawn Lee's life matters. What's your reaction to that? Because there was a lot of pushback saying, no, this is every single day there seems to be some sort of protest or rally or organization around this, and maybe people just don't understand that.
I agree, because I'm still upset about it now. And I thank those and take my hats off to those who were out there, Father Flager, Gator Bradley, Inglewood, and some of the community. But at the same time, I'm disappointed because when there's an officer shoots an unarmed person, you look across the United States and I lay across the table like this, they would shut down the whole city, block by block. In Chicago here, they want to shut down Michigan and walk all the way to 35th Street, the police headquarters, to protest. But at the same time, this child life matters just like everybody else life matters. If indeed across the United States, and here in Chicago, there's an unarmed person, whether he's black, white, Hispanic, or Mexican, and he's been shot and he's unarmed. I go back. This little baby was unarmed, even though he's a little African-American, but he was unarmed. So where's that same outrage where you can shut down the whole South Side? It don't make no difference to me. And I look at it, and it's disrespectful to me when we can shut down the city, Michigan, walk here, protest City Hall, and disturb the traffic, but we can't do it when an unarmed baby, 9 years, unarmed, executed. Yeah, it's very disrespectful to me. This can be anybody's baby. I have no disrespect and mean no disrespect to the city of Chicago. I love the city of Chicago and the people, but we must understand this little boy's life should have mattered too. When you look across the United States and other countries and other states, but we don't want to riot. We're not saying riot. But when you want to protest and you want to upset about something, get upset about this little baby's life.
Andrew Holmes, community activist in Chicago, part of the new group Chicago Survivors. He's a crisis responder. He's my guest tonight at the Big Table. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, talk a little bit more about your life with violence and continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. My guest tonight, The Big Table, Andrew Holmes, longtime Chicago activist, crisis responder with Chicago Survivors, a new program with the city of Chicago to help with victims and families, victims of gun violence. You're suited for this because of your relationship and history with violence. When you were 25 years old, you were shot. What do you remember about that?
I just remember going through an alley and shot ring out, glass broken in my car, and I didn't know I was hit at the time, but I got about a block or two away and just felt pain. Next thing after that, I passed out. After that, I woke up in the hospital. And, you know, from there it was history. I was shot in the artery and had to learn how to walk all over again. But it's still painful, but at the same time, I think about my daughter.
Yeah.
Taking one to the chest and I took one to the artery, and I survived. But years after that, my baby took one and didn't survive. And it's tough on any parent out here when you looking at a birth certificate and at the same time you're putting a death certificate on top of it at the same time. So it's tough.
For you in the work that you're in, being a crisis responder, having to deal with grief, having to deal with trauma, having to deal with the emotion, visceral emotion in the immediate, even the short term and then the long term, your history with violence, you yourself losing a loved one, a child, does it help you?
Yeah, my daughter started out with me when I started. So her death didn't do nothing but make me stronger. It didn't stop me, just make me stronger to help enhance the quality of life of others, no matter what type of violence it is. You know, I'm, like you say, a crisis responder through Chicago Survivor, but on another note, I am the president of Operation Restoring Innocence, where we deal with human trafficking in the city here, missing children. But dealing with this violence, it takes a different toll because you have to try to get out of here and save the next person's life. You have to be proactive. And meaning by being proactive, you have to do your seminars. You have to talk to these families. You have to get to the next door neighbor. You have to find out where this hatred is at so much in each and every family. You have hatred among each other. Even myself, I have been through many neighborhoods, and I put it this way. I'm not well-liked by everybody, but I just keep smiling because I'm going to save somebody.
How hard is it to keep smiling? I mean, to lose your daughter, to be immersed in gun violence everywhere you go, your job is. I mean, if you know, dispatch says there's a homicide, you have to go. It's a very bleak outlook for you as a human being. I can't fathom being around all of that pain and grief all the time.
Well, I'm constantly bleeding on the inside, but I try to keep smiling and keep a good face on the outside because, you know, approaching these parents, I know how they're feeling. I know what they're going through. And, you know, I've just tried to keep it real with them. When I'm there for you, I'm there for you. I'm trying to help them 100%. But if I'm there and I can save your child and save the next child, that's what I'm going to do. But it's very disturbing sometimes if I can get on the scene and I get there, as I usually been there sometime, and a person is still living. A person is holding your hand. A person is asking for his mother. And that's hard, because if that person expire during that course, is, do you want to let the parents know what was his last words? And I say, absolutely yes, I will. Because so many cases, they say, call my mama. I don't want to die. I done been there before. I done seen it. I done heard them. So it is tough out here. It's not easy responding to these homicides.
No. In both situations in your life, when you were shot, when your daughter died, obviously the healing part of it, you talked about, you know, having to learn to walk again. Talk about, you know, living life without your daughter. In that process, there wasn't an Andrew Holmes to help Andrew Holmes. You know, you go and you help people. You help people figure it out. Who helped you?
Prayer. Through prayer. I knew one thing. I knew my mother was out there somewhere, but through prayer, guts. I was very weak. I gave up. Lily gave up. I tell you, I didn't want to walk. I didn't want to go through physical therapy. I gave up. But through prayer and faith, I'm still here. But I wish I had been there for my daughter. It's hard to, you go there and your baby's laying on that bed and ain't moving. And you're looking at her face, and I looked at it, and I can just see that her last words was probably, my daddy. Me and my daughter had a bond. I raised her, and it's hard looking at her on that bed. And I know she was calling me, because at the time this shooting happened, we would call each other every other night about that time. And when that call came through, I thought that was her. So it's tough on these families.
And that emotion is the emotion that is your, it's your, I mean, it's your weapon to fight against violence.
Yeah, that's my backbone. That's my strength. Didn't do nothing but make me stronger, make me eager to get out of here and get ahead of it to try to stop the next person from discharging a weapon. Because once that weapon is discharged and on the other end, it's a body. So it's more than just racing to the crime scene of a homicide. We have to get ahead of that and try to put a stop to and educate them before it happened. And that's what we're doing through so many organizations that are out here helping. It's not Big Eyes and Little U. It's other organizations and other men out here that are helping, that are on the streets, that are in the churches. So we work hand in hand. So we have to get ahead of it. We have to, because if we don't get ahead of it and don't talk to these families, the next young man or the next young girl is going to get a weapon, and once they discharge it, it's too late.
Do you see through your work, all the work that you've done over the decades here in Chicago, to interrupt violence, to do Chicago Survivors, Innocence Project, whatever it is, do you see it improving? And can you see, as Andrew Holmes, can you see a time when gun violence isn't as much of an epidemic as it is today?
I can see at the end of the light and throughout my work that I'm reaching the people I need to reach. May not reach them all, but I'm reaching them. And as many other men are out here, they are reaching, and I talk to them all the time. They say, they not listening. Yeah, they listening. You just ain't talking. Because if you start talking and reach out to them and show them some tough love, 9 out of that 10, you probably going to save 8, because you always going to have 1, 2, maybe 3 slip through the cracks trying to prove something to somebody, and it be too late. And they're sitting in juvenile, or they're sitting in the institute saying, you know what? That man tried to tell me something. Now I'm sitting here the rest of my life. If I had to listen, I probably would be out there enhancing the quality of life for somebody else. So we're reaching them. We just ain't reaching them all.
I think you obviously, with the life that you have and the work that you do, your vantage point to tell us, WGN audience, to tell Chicago, what's the cause of this violence?
Well, in so many ways, it all starts at home. You know, the way you're raised, the way you show tough love, and in so many cases that, and I say it over and over again, parents have to be parents. I mean, you can't do narcotics in front of your kids. You can't do narcotics at all. You just can't do it. When I was growing up, if my parents had company over, I was in the room. You got to be some tough parents out here. And I say this over and over again, charge it to my head, not my heart, but when a male has a child and you have a little boy and you in the narcotic trade, the narcotic business out here, you showing him what job that he should have. Instead of going to work, getting a job, showing him how to be a man. Because if you take him to that corner each and every day and putting his hat left or right, you're training him. He's in school. He's in school. Same as a daughter with her mother. She's watching what mama do. If you're not training them to be productive in life, guess what? Then they're going to fall in left field. They're going to go in a rabbit hole, and it's going to be hard as hell to get them out. Mm-hmm. So if you showing them this trade, guess what? As soon as they get about 9, then they out of control. Now you want to point the finger at the mayor. You want to point the finger at the governor. You want to point the finger at other people. You have to point the finger back at yourself on how you raised that child. And if you're going to be a father, be a tough father. Show him some tough love. How to be a man, not a thug. A mother. Raise him the way you're supposed to raise him, the way you was raised. How to enjoy life. Chicago's a beautiful city, but it's all how you raise your kids.
You grew up here. You've had just unimaginable pain. Why did you stay here? What keeps you in Chicago? What keeps you on the south side of Chicago trying to help people? What is it that kept you here?
I love the city. I have a lot of fun in the city. I had my ups and downs in the city. But at the same time, there's so much that you can do here to enhance the quality of life of them. And they say so much has been taken away from us. But, yeah, at the same time, we need more funding here. We need more funding here instead of them spending billions and billions of dollars to fight things overseas when we ought to be fighting them and putting them here. But when we get what we need here as far as funding, parents need to get up and take the kids to where these funding's at. Mm-hmm. If, you know, they're taking them out of the park district, then the attendance ain't in the park district. Take your kids to the park district. If they're free, take them there. I mean, you got free classes there. Your computer class, they'll show them what to do with their hands. There's a lot to do in the city of Chicago. You know, instead of this gun violence, get back to taking your children to see their relative. Half of the time, when they bump heads, they fighting each other and don't even know their relatives because they're not taking them to meet the relative. They're not taking them to get into activity. Show them some love. Bring them back to the table instead of eating outside at a restaurant or eating in the bedroom. Bring them to the table where everybody's eating at the same time. It still goes on here. Still a lot of parents like that here in the city here. It's a lot to do in Chicago. It's a lovely city. You can't blame the mayor for what's going on, governors or anybody. We must take control of our own church. It's so much to do here. It's a beautiful city.
Andrew Holmes, longtime Chicago activist, crisis responder with Chicago Survivors. Thank you so much for coming down and being my guest tonight at the big table. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Much more to come here on The Download tonight. The 9 o'clock hour, only at the halfway point. Andrew Holmes, that was great. You see Andrew Holmes all the time. You know, I saw him at the police press conference for Laquan McDonald, the announcement and release of that tape. He's at everything. And he's front and center with the police. He's front and center with the community. He's front and center with protests. He's a good guy to have on to talk about the issues of gun violence in the city, and I'm glad he came down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was unimaginable pain. And the idea that I thinking about that as we were talking more about the different communities we serve here for WGN, and if there was somebody in your community, if you're listening right now and maybe you live in I don't know, like Will County or maybe McHenry County. And there was somebody that whose job it was to listen to the scanner and show up and go through the process of, you know, dealing with victims' families. It's unheard of. I mean, this is one of those jobs that specifically is for the South Side of Chicago, and it's something that I can't fathom. I can't fathom that is a job that Andrew has to do, Mr. Holmes has to do every single night.
Yeah.
8 dead, 20 shot this weekend.
You know, we talked to Peter Nikias a while back, you know, who covers this, and yeah, he kind of talked about the same thing, about just how tough it is to see. And imagine kind of raising that another level to be Andrew Holmes, where you're actually talking with the family and helping them grieve. It's very commendable.
It's a two-year program, Chicago Survivors. The city's funded for now just because they had to. And it'll be interesting to see if it becomes something that the city continues, if it becomes more of, as I opened my, I got a note from my escrow, my tax stuff for my mortgage this weekend saying, hey, just to let you know, the new taxes have been figured out. You need to put in a little bit more.
Came up a little short, did you?
Yeah. But I was like, well, my tax dollars, I don't want to sound like the stereotypical talk radio host. Hey, where do my tax dollars go? But I would say that I would definitely give my tax dollars to a program like that. That's something that I know that if that happened to my loved ones, I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know what to do, and I can understand people with less resources, and it's just something they don't think about. And just the police part of it alone, like the idea of police officers, even now, after the Laquan McDonald video, being disrespected and not being able to do their job to cordon off the yellow tape, not because people have a problem with police officers, but because they're dealing with something that's so shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Their loved one is in the middle of the street. And for someone like Andrew Holmes to come along and be able to explain why that's there, I mean, he said it, you know, like to explain to the this is so morose, so, you know, so shy. The idea that to explain why the body's still there. Because that was a big issue with the shooting in Ferguson, that the body was left out all day. Now, that was something that felt very disrespectful. And so you could see how that would trigger people if more than 10 minutes, the body's still laying there, that people are like, why are they still, you know, and Andrew Holmes is the person who comes along and explains it all. Wow. There you go. I don't know if this is news or what, but the mayor just said that he is going, in response to the Laquan McDonald video release in the case, he's going to be putting together a commission on accountability, police accountability, and have results by March 31st.
Yeah, I just saw that.
Not exactly what, you know, I think the city's asking for.
Task force?
I don't remember drumming on Michigan Avenue and being like, task force now! Task force now! A task force. A commission. What is the commission going to say? I mean, I guess that's where you have to start. The problem is it's non-binding. This commission of people came back and said, yeah, we got a serious problem with the police. Yeah, they'll say, okay, well, thank you for that. We appreciate you typing that up. Thank you for your work.
Then he's off to Paris.
Exactly. We'll have more on that. You know, I'm interested. Like I said, I'm gonna reach out to Jamie Calvin, who we've had on the program a couple times, and he was the guy who you've seen him everywhere. But we had talked about trying to get him in studio to do a big table.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna reach out to him and get him in here because I'd love to know more, because he was the one behind the Invisible Institute who really pushed this. He's the one who first started to get the video released. But then also, I keep seeing him as just sort of the person who, when everyone else wouldn't pay attention, it was brushed underneath the rug and nobody pays attention to all the evidence or videos being withheld. He was the one who said, no, that's just not right.
Yeah, there's a great piece in The Atlantic over the weekend where he's referenced quite a bit in it, Jamie Calvin. Love to have him on again.
Well, definitely. Okay, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour here. Very excited. We're going to shift and we're going to talk to Dave Reedy. Dave, a novelist now, the voiceover artist, and of course he had a collection of short stories before. Dave, it's hot right now. He's hot. He's going to Brooklyn. His next stop is Brooklyn. That's pretty hot. The hottest neighborhood in the country. And Dave's going, no big deal. If I went tomorrow, they'd be like, can we see your papers? And I'd be like, here you go. And they're like, we don't think you got the street cred to be in Brooklyn. Have you written a novel? I'd be like, no, I host an AM talk radio. And then be like, I think Queens might be better for you. And they put me over there. I think Hoboken. I'd be like, okay, I'll take the bus to Hoboken. Also coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to talk about the feel-good story of the year, the decade, the city. There's so many bad storylines. A good one, Phillips High School wins the 4A state championship football this weekend. Congratulations to that team. The first in the history of public league to win a state championship. That's unfathomable to me. And they did it, and we're going to talk with the coach coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. So much, much more coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with until 11 o'clock when Patty Vasquez, pretty late with Patty Vasquez, takes over. Well, you know, we are coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. We're going to talk Bulls. The Bulls and the Spurs right now tied up 89 all. They're at the replay booth, as everybody does now, to end an NBA basketball game. It's like, that's one sport where I feel like I'm still okay with the ref getting it wrong because it just stops the game. Like, I mean, it's like every play. Well, let's go back to the replay.
Right.
And then they sit around for 15 minutes trying to figure out which seven-footer's knee the ball went off of. That's the NBA now. Anyway, Matt Klein's going to join us. He was a regular for the Cubs fan jam when we used to have the Cubs fan jam. We decided to do the Bulls fan jam. We wanted to do every game. And then it just was like, that's a lot of games, man. It's a lot of regular season games. So we were only taking the big ones. So, like, when we're on the air, the Spurs and the Bulls at the United Center, that's a pretty good one, right?
That's a big one.
If it's the Bucks and the Bulls, we might not, although that's better. I shouldn't, you know, for our Milwaukee listeners, I feel like.
Yeah, that'll be a rivalry again.
That may Jason Kidd maybe turning things around there, so. But that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. My next guest, debut novel, is a talk of the town. Dave Reedy has been a writer in Chicago for a couple years now. He's published a collection of short stories called Captive Audience that paved the way for his novel, The Voice Over Artist, out on Curbside Splendor Press. The novel explores the concept of voice, what it's like to live without it, and what do we do when we find it. Dave Reedy is going to be in Brooklyn this week and back in Chicago for a conversation with Scott Turow at the bookstall in Winnetka on December 9th. Dave, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me,
congrats,
Justin.
Congrats on the novel.
Thank you.
This is The Voice Over Artist. I mean, it really is a there's a play on voice everywhere. Tell us a little bit about the plot before we move forward.
Sure. So it's the story of Simon Davies. Simon is a man with a stutter, and at 7 years old, there's an event with his father after which Simon decides he's going to go silent. And he doesn't think he's going to go silent forever, but his voice actually atrophies, and he ends up silent for 18 years. And then after the death of his mother, he decides he has to try to find a way to rebuild his voice and try to chase his dream of becoming like one of the voices on the radio who were his best company during his 18 years of silence.
The voiceover, commercial voiceover guys.
That's right, yeah.
And the guy he looks up to, Larry Sellers.
Larry Sellers is his fictional voiceover hero. But I feel like longtime Chicago radio listeners would appreciate, maybe have imagined a Larry Sellers in their own mind, right? Because, you know, he's the guy who does Juul commercials, right? And other things. It's
this week at Juul.
Exactly.
That's what I think when I'm reading it. This week at Juul, ham, $2 right. a pound.
That's right. Get happy and get excited. Yeah, it's a bit of a love letter to commercial radio in that way. And it's really, Simon is really focused on the commercials themselves because he's he thinks that the craft is all about perfection. And over the arc of the book, he finds out that there's more to art than perfection. There's something more human in it.
What made you set your novel this way? You know, mm-hmm. because like you said, you're up in Chicago, you know the voices. But what about voice drew you to writing a full novel about it?
Yeah. So there have been a lot of, in my work, I've often dealt with communication difficulties of one kind or another. People are trying to make themselves understood. People are trying to make themselves
you know, like make themselves heard. And this one, this was just another way to attack that and really kind of focus on, you know, that actual physical stutter as in like kind of a speech impediment. And then, of course, those years of silence when the person actually literally cannot make himself heard. I thought it was interesting kind of actually. And then, of course, metaphorically, you know, really, I mean, it's about as isolating a thing as I could think of. If you're around people, but you cannot speak to them, and you're sort of at the mercy of whatever they say to you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that to me seemed like an interesting thing to explore in fiction and something that could sustain the length of a novel.
Well, it's great conflict. I mean, it's great. It's not just that, because this is just an entryway. Simon's just an entryway into his family, right. His relationships with his brother. Who's in the improv comedy world, not unlike your brother.
That's right. That's right.
It's such a, like you said, like an ode to Chicago, because there's the voiceover part, the commercials and the references to a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But then there is this part that is about the improv comedy world, about trying to be on, being on stage. The brother is Connor, right?
That's right. Connor. Simon's brother, Connor.
Yeah. The brother spends his life in improv comedy trying to find his voice.
Yep. That's exactly right. And that was another kind of, thing I really wanted to try and attack in this novel, because the Chicago improv world, as you well know, is really rich and interesting. And, you know, it actually has an increasingly interesting stand-up world as well. But, you know, I felt like it hadn't really been given a literary treatment, at least not a fictional literary treatment. And I was like, well, maybe this is one of those things that I'm just lucky enough as a novelist to kind of encounter and kind of know a way into kind of explore in the context of a novel. And, you know, I really thought that there's so much interesting human and artistic and creative stuff happening on that scene that it really deserved a full literary treatment. And I was really, really wanted to give it one.
That's what I love about it, too, because there is so many different ways to play upon the idea of voice. Mm-hmm. And in improv comedy, that is, you know, as Connor is trying to find his voice, is he going to be on a Saturday Night Live? Is he going to, what's he going to do with his life? Mm-hmm. And he's performing on stage every single night. Yeah. There's something about that voice. There's something about the literal voice of Simon trying to find his. There's
right.
the voice. His father had a stutter. It's just, I really love how, not even to mention the sort of lore of Larry Sellers and his agent.
Right.
There just seems to really be a lot about voice. And I find that to be a really strong way to approach work.
Well, yeah, I think there was more about voice than I actually expected. The first few drafts of the book were almost entirely told from Simon's point of view. And then, you know, it was only in like the subsequent like fourth and fifth drafts in which I was able to really get these other characters' voices, give them a chance to be narrators in the novel.
Yeah, every chapter is a different character not narrating the novel.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And so then the voice stuff really took off, because I had to create and inhabit these other characters' voices. It wasn't enough just to have Simon, and that's really when it got actually interesting. Even more interesting for me. Obviously, it was interesting enough to do it three times through, but but on the fourth and fifth is when it really started to come alive for me.
We're talking with Dave Reedy here on The Download. The Voiceover Artist is his new novel. Chicago writer is going to be at the bookstall in Winnetka on December 9th with an interview with Scott Turow. When we come back, let's talk about your voice.
Sounds great.
It's The Download here on WGN. That was a read. I felt like I should have read that like Larry Sellers, the character in Dave Reedy's novel, The Voiceover Artist. It's Cyber Monday shopping time. Is that it?
You've got the golden pipes. That's it.
The coupon code TCXWGN. It's amazing to me because there's so many great voices here at WGN. Mm-hmm. Like Orion Samuelson is here.
Yep.
You hear some of the greats. Even Mark Tears got good pipes, but it's fun to read your book and be like, some guys like
I mean,
this.
That's the thing. I mean, I think it makes a difference to people too. I mean, some of these folks who really are making their living with their voice, I mean, they've got beautiful instruments, and then they can treat the microphone like an instrument too. They really know how to use it. And, you know, it's really kind of, it's great to hear, you know, it's like hearing something beautiful.
Dave Reedy is the author of The Voiceover Artist. You can see him at the bookstall in Winnetka on December 9th, the interview with Scott Turow. This is your first novel before you had the short story collection.
Correct.
That you did a couple years back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said in the intro, you know, a couple, he's been a writer for a couple years now, which is kind of disrespectful in the way that, you know, you're just young.
Mm-hmm.
You've been, but you've been writing your entire life. What drove you? At what point do you say, you know what, I'm going to make my life about trying to publish this novel?
So this novel in particular, the idea for it was born. I actually went and found the notebook the other day. It was October 9th, 2007. So it's 8 years in the making. And I had finished my story collection, and a novel had always been a bit of like the lion in the road, the next thing to try. And so I really thought I had something with this idea of a stutterer who wants to hear himself on the radio someday and has kind of a troubled relationship with his father and his brother, and who loses his mother. So the initial notes, obviously things really evolved, but the character was Simon. Wow. From the beginning, and really kind of explored it from there. And once I'd committed to it, it kept interesting me this whole time. So I figured if it could interest me that long, it could interest readers for the span of 300 pages.
Let's go back to when you started your career as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the opportunities that were provided to you, if you weren't going to go publish at curbside, mm-hmm. if you were, you know, short stories, mm-hmm. online publishing, things like that, how did you make your name and continue to get closer to being able to publish a novel?
So when I first started, the internet was like in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was kind of like the Wild West, and the gatekeepers were sort of gone. You could start your own website, and if you thought you knew a community of people who could write, you could, you know, publish your own. We did a lot of what we called literary humor at the time, and folks like Chicago writers like Claire Zulke and filmmaker Steve Delahoyd and others would kind of contributed to those. And, you know, some of those relationships still exist. One of the guys that I wrote with at that time is a guy named Mike Sachs, who's a Vanity Fair contributor,
yeah,
and a great author of comedy, books about comedy writers, including his latest Poking the Dead Frog. And Mike is going to be appearing on a panel with me in Brooklyn, accepted my invitation. That all goes back to early 2000 internet, kind of collegiality.
Where do you do that, like in Brooklyn? I mean, is it a panel discussion as we know it to be traditional, like three authors and people ask?
Yeah, so I'll be the moderator. Uh-huh. I'll be asking, basically we're calling it the Lit Comedy Roundtable. We did one in Chicago a couple of weeks ago at the Annoyance Theater, and it was great. We had great panel here in Chicago, and it basically seeks to explore where do books and comedy meet, and does one influence the other in any real way? And we had kind of just a gathering of comedy people who love books and book people who love comedy to get together and talk about that. And we're going to do the same thing in Brooklyn at Word Bookstore. They have a nice performance space in the basement of that place, and so hope to get some people out to kick that around.
For you as an author in Chicago, and you have been since the late 90s, mm-hmm. been a part of the literary scene here. And you've seen it kind of go up and down. We've had a lot of different authors on, from Joe Mino has been here.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of Claire. Claire was here as
yep.
well. A lot of people who came in from, who aren't from Chicago, who are authors. But they all point to bookstores, mm-hmm. Like the Cellar in Lincoln Square,
yep.
but and even the Bookstall in Winnetka, or
yep.
out west in Naperville, Anderson.
Yep, it's Anderson's. Yep.
As places that were, and even Borders and places like that, there was a scene here, and at a certain point or another, that scene, like everything, kind of it fell apart in the mm-hmm. way that there's only independent bookstores left. And so, as an author, how do you get your word out? You mentioned the Annoyance Theater. You mentioned what you're doing in Brooklyn. Do you have to find alternative venues to be able to do the kind of things that you need to do to promote the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, and I think the issue is, there's nothing wrong with the bookstores. They've got their community of people around them, and frankly, they're vital pieces of the literary community. The more bookstores we have and the more kind of communities they can sustain, the better off anyone who loves books is, whether they're a writer or a reader. I just figured going out to promote this book that, I didn't want to do that many events where it was just me at a bookstore doing a reading in some town where I don't know anybody, right? I mean, that's not going to draw. So, the folks at Curbside were really helpful in helping me find venues, and then and I was able to reach out and help find some people to help me do some of these alternative venues where maybe we're reading with a few people, and then, you know, something like the Lit Comedy Roundtable, where the book is kind of tangential to it. It's just, what's one of the cultural conversations that the book seeks to engage? And of course, it'll be for sale there, and if anybody wants to buy it, I'll sign it. But really, I mean, I just wanted to talk to some interesting people and explore in conversation some of the issues I'd spent the last 8 years exploring in the book.
I remember, and it's off on a tangent, that when I was doing Schadenfreude, the comedy stuff, Neil Pollack was a friend of mine here in Chicago, big writer, and he would come back, and we would go there and stunt different comedy bits during his reading.
So I witnessed one of these.
Did you?
Yeah, at a Barbara's, I believe. Yeah, I witnessed.
I forgot which one. There was the one where I was the bike messenger that said that he stole it from me.
Oh, yeah.
There was
That's right.
There was one down in Hyde Park that I remember that we did an absurdist thing with a flute. And so when he started reading, like, we created like a dream sequence from the audience, like popped up. Like, all this kind of crazy stuff. But the whole intention was Neil wanted to get out of that staid kind of, I'm going to read and there's going to be an audience that's going to go.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think Neil has that right. I mean, I think that it, you know, when if people tell me, you know, like, okay, you can read for 10 to 20 minutes, I'm like, that sounds like 8 minutes.
Let's do a tight three.
Exactly right. Leave them wanting something more and maybe not snoozing in their chairs. But I mean, I think that's the tough thing. I mean, it's not like live music where, you know, it's probably meant first and foremost to be performed live, and then the recording of it is kind of a secondary artifact. You know, the books are meant to be read, and they're meant to be read, you know, by an individual in kind of a, you know, in kind of a solitary experience that hopefully is made communal by the fact that other people are reading it. But you know, reading the book out loud, and I'm you know, is you know, it's, even if you're a good reader, it's only so good an experience. So, I mean, we really try to make sure that, you know, you got multiple people keeping it short and keeping it interesting, so there's good variety, or that, you know, there's an interesting Q&A perhaps, or, you know, if we can put one together, a panel discussion, and kind of get to some of the issues that the book gets into.
The Voiceover Artist is the new book by Dave Reedy. Dave, stick around.
Please.
Yeah, we'll do some more after the news. You can find it at Curbside Splendor. He's going to be at the bookstall in Winnetka in conversation with Scott Turow, which that's another great way to do an actual an entertaining book signing and promotion, the conversation.
I'm really excited about that.
We'll talk more with Dave after the news. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. Chicago Bulls beat the Spurs. Hey, NBA Finals, as I said at the beginning of the show, NBA Finals matchup preview. If LeBron, Kyrie Irving, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, and all of the Toronto Raptors try to climb Mount Everest.
Right.
And there's an avalanche. And I'm not saying they have to die. I'm just saying, like, maybe it's like the movie, it takes like 26 days to find them, and it's like April, so they can't play anymore.
Yep.
Then I think we could be seeing an NBA Finals matchup.
Now that all could happen.
So we're going to do a Bulls fan jam about what you didn't see, what you weren't paying attention to. Matt Klein will give us. And Matt already told me, Pete, you'll love this. Matt told me that he's in Arizona, and they have the NBA TV feed. And so he doesn't get the Comcast feed, so he doesn't get Stacey King. He gets whoever the other people were, or not. I was like, you're fired if you can't tell me what Stacey King said. There's a mouse in the house. That's what we want to hear. We don't want to hear, you know, what Reggie Miller said.
No,
nobody wants to.
No, Stacey's got a good thing.
Are you a basketball fan, Dave?
I am.
Kobe Bryant, you got any words on Kobe Bryant?
Oh boy, I'm afraid to say anything negative about Kobe, even here, you know. Like, I mean, I don't want to. I think look, he had an amazing career, and you know, I mean, I think I hope he gets to go out on something resembling his terms. I think, you know, I hope he gets healthy enough to have a good final season.
Yeah, it ain't going to happen.
I don't think it is either.
He says this is his last year. Do they do it like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and like he gets a boat every time he goes to a different town? You remember that?
Like, it'll be like, or that Derek Jeter farewell tour.
Right.
Yeah, right.
But I remember Kareem, he'd be like playing against the Milwaukee Bucks, right? And we're like, we got you this yacht.
That's right.
And they pull a boat onto the court, and you're like, what is that? Like, all right, enough. Like, he's retiring. That's great. But
it could happen.
I want to see what Kobe gets from the different towns, from Knicks and from the Bulls, things like
Chicago
that.
Chicago will do something.
Well, I wonder. Dave Reedy in studio with me, the novelist. His first novel, his debut novel, The Voiceover Artist, is now out, Curbside Splendor Press. He's going to be at the book stall in Winnetka on December 9th in conversation with Scott Turow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Let's talk about this. We were talking about the Chicago literary scene before we went to the news. And you know, it kind of set it up that, like, well, it's different than it used to be because the bookstores have kind of gone away and there's only a few independents. But I didn't get a chance to, like, ask the follow-up, which is it's on an upswing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that the shows that you're talking about, the shows that may be at the Hideout or other places, they're packed. Yep. There are a lot of different people interested in the Chicago literary scene.
Yep. There are a lot of... a lot of people in this town very passionate about writing and about live performance of writing. It's a great live lit town. And I think that, you know, one of the things I've noticed over the last 15 years is that there's a lot of young energy in it right now. There are a lot of young writers coming out of the MFA programs that are in Chicago, Columbia, Roosevelt School, the Art Institute, Northwestern, others. And those writers are choosing to stay. I mean, a lot of them are choosing to stay. And because of that, we all get the benefit of their talent and their energy. They're starting reading series. They are proving to be an excellent audience for one another's work and for work of people like, you know, me and others who are publishing books with Chicago publishers. And I think, you know, that's exactly what the scene needs. Is there's this you know, this younger energy and really no shortage of talent. So
you know, it's just so interesting to think about, because any good scene, regardless if it's music, if it's theater, if it's film, if it's live lit, it really does. It feels like the way to make it bigger is if the college levels, the college programs, like you just mentioned, invest.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in any case, any situation. You see, think about that with the indie film. Yep. It just seems like, okay, we're going to be an indie film town.
Right.
Well, okay, so then so you really do, because that's where you're going to be able to attract talent that don't necessarily grow up in Chicago, but they come here from other places.
That's right.
And they stay.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, there are Chicago writers, myself included, who left town to get their MFA. And, you know, and that's not to say that at the time, you know, I wouldn't have been really happy to go to one of the Chicago programs. But I think fewer Chicago writers are going to have to make that decision. And it's going to attract people to this town, which is a great town to write in. There's a lot of what makes us human is happening here. And there are a lot of contradictions here that are worth exploring in writing of all kinds, fiction, nonfiction, whatever you've got. And I think that's a really positive sign for the scene here, is that there are people here coming and staying.
For you, I talked in the intro about Captive Audiences, which is a collection of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Getting that published and put out, and I say it paved the way for the novel. What was after you put that out and you said, okay, and this is 2007, you started scribbling the idea of this novel, what does it take to actually get the novel published? I mean, is it just a simple, I have an agent and I'm going to pitch, like sort of a traditional model?
So that is how it goes for many authors. I actually, I had been working with an agent during some of the time I was writing this, and then we couldn't really agree on the direction of this novel, but I really wanted to stay with it, and we had kind of an amicable parting. So by the time I was ready to take The Voiceover Artist out to publishers, I was on my own. And I was lucky enough that, you know, on the first day that I took it out to independent publishers, I wrote to two, and one of them was Curbside Splendor.
Hmm.
So I was really lucky that Curbside decided to take me on. They're distributed nationally by Consortium. The books are very well designed. They've published many good authors and many good books.
A lot of Chicago authors.
That's
yeah.
right. And they've got great Chicago programming. So, you know, I was like, for a writer who's making his or her home in Chicago, I'm hard pressed to think of many better places. So I felt lucky about that.
Let me ask you this, you know, as we sort of wrap up, it's so early. I mean, because you're just starting, you know, you've been in sort of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
Here comes the tour, right? Here comes Brooklyn. You're going to hit up, I think you're hitting Boston.
That's right.
And then you're back to Chicago with a lot of dates here and there. You know, as you think about this, is the process done for you? Meaning, is the process of the novel done, or is it not over until you've finished all the promotion, when you've finished all the touring? When is a book actually on your shelf done?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like it was done when the editor-in-chief at Curbside, Naomi Huffman, said, okay, we're done with the editing. Because, you know, it's one of those things where you could tinker and rewrite forever if you're serious about it, and right. I definitely was. You know, I spent 8 years writing a book very few people were waiting for. So I was definitely serious about it. But, you know.
That's a good blurb.
Yeah, right. The book few people were waiting for. Catch the fever. So, you know, but I think that, you know, you could write it forever, but then eventually, like they say, with any work of art, you just got to decide, or somebody's got to tell you that it's done and kind of take it from you. So, I mean, it felt done when I got sent the final copies and I actually did get to put it on my shelf. It's funny because writing is this very public act, but a lot of the real satisfaction of it is in these very private moments. Like when, a writer you admire agrees to do a blurb for you, or when you get to take the finished copy and put it on your own shelf. You know, it's a public act, but a lot of the satisfactory moments, the most satisfying moments, are private.
For you, you know, putting this together and having a published novel, it really does solidify you as a full time writer. And you've for your whole life you've had that sort of split personality where mm-hmm. you've had a day job and that, which yep. was not, which was writing, but it wasn't, you know,
yep.
you weren't a novelist,
right?
And you've been able to work on your stuff on the side. Does that change now that you published?
It's not going to change for me. I have a full-time job at a place called Closer Look, which is a longtime Chicago company. I've been there for almost 10 years. I'm lucky to be there. And, you know, I also have a family. And so I think that, you know, publishing books, especially literary fiction, it's hard to do it frequently enough to make a living. It's mm-hmm. hard to do it, you know, sort of well enough and broadly enough to make a living from it. So, any money that I make, which is, you know, to be frank, not that much from my books is just sort of gravy. And, you know, it's other things that are motivating me to do it. I mean, I just really, wanted to be a writer and really wanted to tell these stories in particular. And so that's really what has motivated me to do it. And, I think, you know, I would do it for free, but I mean, there's a lot to being well published, and luckily mm-hmm. Curbside has made that happen for me.
So what's next for you? I mean, as you finish this up, it might be too early to tell, but are you thinking, okay, I'm going for novel number two?
Well, I've been working on a memoir style project in which I've been trying to find out some more about my a grandfather that I never knew, who died before I was born. Kind of wrestle with some of my fear of becoming him and all of his good parts and bad parts. And I've been working on that for about 3 years. It's still all in a very rough state, but, yeah, I'm thinking I might turn my attention to nonfiction, for the next project, and we'll see if it ever becomes a book.
Well, the debut novel, The Voiceover Artist, is out right now. Dave Reedy is the author. You can find it on Curbside Splendor Press. He's going to be at the bookstall in Winnetka on December 9th with In Conversation with Scott Turow. Before that, you're going to be in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
They let you in.
That's right.
It was super cool of them.
That's right. It was really cool.
Sax probably helped.
That helps. Yeah, you've got to have a guardian. Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad. And if you run into any trouble there and they're like, you got to get out, just give me a call.
I will. You know, you're known there.
I know a couple of people there, not enough, but I can get you on the outside. I can get you out. I can get you at least to Queens and we can figure out how to get you out from there.
Well, I don't know. We may never want to leave. Who knows?
No. Dave, thanks for coming down. Good to see you, man.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
So download here on WGN coming up. I'm very excited. Phillips High School coach Troy McAllister is going to join us. I'm very excited to talk to him about their 4A state championship. It's unbelievable to me, Pete, that this is the first public league school to win a state championship.
I know. How about that? With all
what
that
is that
talent.
About? I mean, I'll ask the coach. It's just interesting because there is a lot of talent. Those are some. And most of those football teams. Maybe it's resources, I guess, but most of those football teams in the inner cities of the past, you've seen them go on to be NFL stars mm-hmm. and players have been involved. And you see, and I guess it used to be that way as well, in basketball, which is surprising as well, that the basketball state champs always went to one of the downstate teams or the suburban teams. But I think that's changed over the last mm-hmm. couple of years. The city league teams
Simeon,
have won.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I mean, it could be. You know, there's a high school up near me, Sullivan High School, and there's like a park like a couple blocks away where I walk the dogs. And I see them practicing, and it just looks like it just looks ragged, you know. It's like not a lot of people out there. It's a horrible park where dogs go to the bathroom. the dummies, you know, right. The tackling dummies and stuff like that are just like in ill repair.
I've seen Rocky III. And Rocky doesn't win. I don't want to give it away, but he doesn't win if he doesn't go back to the roots to the crappy gym.
All right,
and he goes to the rich gym. After he fights Hulk Hogan, and it's just not the same. In Rocky IV, Ivan Drago,
mm-hmm.
he's got steroids and computers, which were bad things, you know, in the mid-80s or late 80s. Computers and needles. And Rocky, he's got the snow. He's got a sled.
You're right.
So you tell those kids up at Sullivan, Pete. No, there was a quote from the coach saying that the only thing they practiced with was footballs. They don't have blocking cage, you know, blocking mm-hmm. machines and dummies and, you know, I guess computers and needles. They just use footballs. So that's a good storyline, and it's exciting. We're going to talk about that. Also coming up, Chicago Bulls beat the San Antonio Spurs. Seems like the Bulls are really they're good for those beating. Last year was Golden State, if you remember. They beat Golden State, and everyone's like, oh. And then they beat the Spurs here. Oh. But does it mean anything? I don't know.
I mean, I think there's a lot of questions about this team early in the season. You know, I don't think you knew what to expect. Just a new coach. You didn't know how Derrick Rose is going to play. I think I've been pleasantly surprised by the start. Were they 10-5?
10-5? It's not bad.
Yeah.
It's five more wins. Than losses.
Yeah, I'll take it.
The tomorrow we're not on because the Chicago Blackhawks mm-hmm. are back. So it's great to see. The Bulls are back tonight. Blackhawks back tomorrow. And they take on Minnesota. And so we'll be back on Wednesday.
That's right.
Which is great because we're going to talk about the Shakespeare 400, which I'm very excited about. That's the 400th birthday celebration for William Shakespeare. They decided to the city and the Chicago Shakes and others are putting on this big festival. I think it's I got to look and see if it's a year-wide thing or what if it's just in the summer. They're celebrating Shakespeare, so there's going to be a lot of Shakespeare events and Shakespeare in the park and Shakespeare on the stages.
Nice.
And a very Shakespeare-immersed Chicago coming up here. So we're going to talk with Barbara Gaines and Chris Henderson about that on Wednesday. And the big table, I'm going to have them in here. Because we kind of mentioned with Chris Jones last week about Shakespeare's presence in this country, and he had mentioned Stratford in Ontario, and then he had mentioned another place maybe in Portland. But he said that Chicago was one of, if not with the Shakespeare 400, it really does have the potential to be the leading Shakespeare producer in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. You seem
impressive.
I was gonna say that's all you got is wow.
Is it going to be? Remember, is this coincide with like talk like Shakespeare Day? There's always one of those days,
right? And then there's going to have to be a hip hop Shakespeare. The Q Brothers are going to have to. They're coming on too. They're coming on next. The two kids. Yeah.
Are they really?
Yeah. Coming up, I think next week they got to show it.
Christmas or they do their
Christmas
version.
Yeah, Christmas version.
Oh yeah, I like those guys. They run a little store up on Lincoln Avenue too.
In pocket there. Yeah. And the Shakespeare Improv at I.O., at Improv Olympic, those guys are phenomenal. You see that show. That's on Friday night. That's like it, where they essentially improvise a Shakespeare play. Blaine and Steve and Brendan and this group, and they befriended Patrick Stewart. Yeah, from Star Trek fame. Well, they had worked together when they did Second City at the Lyric, and Patrick Stewart was the main draw at that show. And so when they went to New York, because they go to New York to perform this, he sits in with them. So he improvises Shakespeare alongside them. Isn't that cool?
It is.
That's what we need more of here in Chicago. We need more like the Dennis Franz comes out and does something like the I don't know what that is.
I saw over the holiday weekend. I'm sure that you're a parade lover.
I love the parades.
So you watched? Did you watch any of the?
I didn't watch any of them.
You didn't watch any of them?
No.
Oh, the Chicago parade was terrific.
You liked it?
Yeah, it was all right.
Yeah, it was all right. Did they have the old, like, they're like, here comes Curious George. And then you could see, like, the duct tape down the side of his arm because it was ripped by an accidental CTA track one time.
No, it was wonderful.
It was wonderful.
But the Thanksgiving, the regular, the Macy's one in mm-hmm. New York City there, I saw a friend of the show, Brian Darcy James,
yeah,
performing Something Rotten.
Yeah, he does that all the time because the Broadway shows, which I also saw that Broadway broke records during the Thanksgiving weekend, by the way. Broadway in general, like, they just broke box office records this year. At the parade, they always have, like, and I think it looks like they lip sync it, right?
Yeah, they do.
It's kind of, it's like one of the more awkward things that you see on television because they get to a certain point and they're like, and then it's so obvious that they're improvising a musical number.
Yeah.
And Brian's always on those things. And Brian is getting rave reviews for his star turn in Spotlight.
Yeah, I went to go see that last week. It was terrific, and he's hilarious in it. I mean, it's not a funny story. I mean, it's not a comedy by any means. It's the sex abuse scandal of the church.
Yeah, but...
But he provides some comic relief, which is which
and he's
is
got
nice.
With his mustache alone. With a mustache. We have to get him on, especially if he gets an Oscar nom. He would probably come on.
Shouldn't get him on a regular? We always call him when he gets an award.
Well, that's what our thing is. That's our relationship. When he gets a nominated for an award, we call him.
Okay.
Otherwise, we don't speak. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. You watching that game intently, huh, Martyr? That Ravens-Browns game's got you on the edge of your seat?
Are you kidding me? Come on, man.
Come on, man.
These guys are, what, a combined 5-15 on the year?
I just wonder if, for whatever reason, when they make the schedule, they're like, and in week 13, and they unveil it to their own marketing team, and they're like, the Browns and the Ravens, because you know they're both going to be great. You know Johnny Manziel and the Ravens are going to be how do you
Johnny
put that?
Johnny Football running for his life from Terrell Suggs.
Right, exactly.
Oh, wait, neither of whom are playing right now. So
it's just I feel like the NFL has to do a better job of anticipating suckage. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like late in the season when it's like week 14, you cannot put the Jacksonville Jaguars, you cannot put the Chicago Bears on Monday Night Football in week 15, week 14.
See, Sundays you have the luxury of flex scheduling, so when you get down to the waning moments of the season, late in the season, you can adjust the schedule. But Monday night, you've got one game,
right,
and that's it.
And I guess they do it, they probably schedule Monday Night Football more on markets and money and the Cleveland and Baltimore markets in some
zigzag way.
Yeah,
because nothing screams money like Baltimore and Cleveland.
Maybe they always put that out, that graph that shows who's fans of where. Maybe like there's a target area in Florida that's both a Cleveland and a Baltimore area, like Clearwater.
But they've already had dinner by 3:30 and they're in bed by 6. So nobody in Florida rooting for either of these teams is up even watching this game.
The only thing, those FanDuels and DraftKings, everyone's like, that's made Monday Night Football relevant. Like, now they're just like, oh, come on, just Justin Tucker, kick a field goal. Kick a field goal from 45 yards out, please.
Yeah, all the degenerates out there are really sweating this one.
And they are. It's the only reason they're watching.
Come on, I put $250 in my account. Let's go.
I saw something on Facebook today that showed, or FanDuel put it out. And they put down an article that essentially, here's the 12 ways that are going to hurt or help you, the 12 plays that could tonight hurt or help you. If McCown gets hurt and Manziel throws to Benjamin for 26 yards, that's good. You know, like it's like one of those things where they just like almost handicapped the plays that were important. A whole different way to watch football. And I love it. I'm not going to lie to you. I love it. Because otherwise, why would anyone watch Cleveland and Baltimore?
It's 27-20 still. Just over 5 minutes remaining.
All right.
I'll keep you posted.
Thank you. Please break in if you can.
I will.
All right. Well, coming up here, we're going to talk with the coach of the Phillips High School 4A winning state title champion football team, the first in public league history. Coach McAllister is going to join us. Also, after the 10:30 news, we're going to talk with Matt Klein about the Bulls-Spurs, a little sports for you here in the 10 o'clock hour. It's been a great show tonight. I mean, it's almost like, and I think, Pete, we got to figure this out. We have to figure out, like, marketing for the download. Like, what? Like it feels like it's a magazine. You know, like, tonight is one of those situations where it feels like a magazine.
That's like our catchphrase?
Yeah. Or I'm not saying, okay, there's more than that.
Yeah.
We need to brainstorm.
I kind of like that, though.
But you kind of nailed that. You'd be great in a brainstorm. We'd be already into the fresh fruit by now.
Done.
You nailed it.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, yeah. Feels like a magazine. It feels like you're flipping through a magazine. No, that's too. Smells like weird European cologne.
Feels like you're listening to a magazine.
Oh yeah, right. And then
sense?
Like yeah, and then make it like rap rock. And you can throw some rap rock in there. Feels like a magazine. Oh. A lot of people out here on Michigan Avenue right now. You see, they got their umbrellas up and their coats on. It's a whole different scheme. When we were doing this back in June and July, people be out here pounding on the window in their jorts, their jean shorts.
People have been coming by a lot to check out our the decorations in the studio.
Yes, there are some very nice decorations in the studio.
There's a...
Tree time. Tree time, right?
Mm-hmm. Tree time. Yeah, tree time. It's got all decked out.
Very. We fit in here on Michigan Avenue with all the decorations. Well, the public schedule has been released for Mayor Rahm Emanuel for tomorrow. And at 11 o'clock, he will announce the creation of a task force on police accountability and answer questions from the media.
Oh, all right.
Should we go? They're not going to let us in, me and you.
Can we get? We need credentials.
Well, we don't have shows. Well, I guess. I mean, you just got to know somebody, right?
Because that Brandon Smith can't get in.
Yeah, he can't get in. But we got credentials. I show him my WGN badge, right?
I don't know if that works. I think I think you need to set it up beforehand. I don't think you get to show up with a WGN.
You know, I will do it, and then I'll make a huge statement, and then we'll do 4 hours at night about how I wasn't let in, all the while knowing that I didn't have the right credential.
Can you give a couple of questions to Alderman Ed Buss?
Yeah, right. Let's see what Ed Buss thinks.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Ed Buss, Alderman Ed Buss. If you've been a longtime listener to this show, you know he makes appearances. He's been out. He doesn't do cold weather. He's actually at his satellite office in Boca Raton. But he may come back. Now that Chewy Garcia's back, you know, why does he get to be the one? That's what I was thinking. Why does Chewy get to be the one who gets to stand up and say this is wrong to the city? Alderman Ed Buss should be able to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
He should be able to come in and be like, this is not new.
Miss that guy.
I know, right?
Don't miss his stench.
We should hook one of those up. You know, we can see if the alderman will come back. Maybe he's back visiting family. Maybe we can get a special holiday, Ed Buss.
Oh, wow.
That's a good idea. I love that we're brainstorming bits for the show. I like it. We have to do that. That's great. The Alderman Ed Buss Christmas time, Christmas family, whatever you want, spectacular, non-denominational. How about that? Does that work? I think that would be a good name for it. Busmas. Merry Busmas. Merry Busmas. The half hour special. That's coming up. That's coming up in the next couple weeks. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock till Patty Vasquez comes in. It's pretty late with Patty Vasquez. We're waiting on Coach McAllister from Phillips High School to call us. We were supposed to do something right now, but he's not coming through, so we may just move some stuff around. No big deal. We can do that. That's what we do. We're flexible. We can make it happen. Well, the Bulls pulled out a big one against the Spurs tonight. We'll take it, right? I guess you would say the return to the United Center works for the Bulls. They were, just came back from their circus trip out west. Very exciting for the Chicago Bulls. And I think, you know, as we said earlier, Pete, we were going to do the Bulls fan jam as much as we possibly could because, well, you know, we loved it. But we kind of ran into a thing where we're like, geez, that's a lot of games. I mean, the Cubs fan jam, you could do it every night. You could, it was like almost like a regular. But the Bulls are so up and down, and we're missing games because we're not on when the Blackhawks or Northwestern plays, or maybe they're playing late because they were on the West Coast. We didn't really get a chance to sort of put our, you know, sort of
stamp
on the Bulls games, and we want to return to that. So tonight's the best way to do that is just kind of take the big ticket items until after Christmas because really – the NBA doesn't really count till after Christmas.
Christmas is a big day for the NBA.
Christmas Day is like the big day, right?
Start watching basketball right at like 10 a.m.
So one of the guys who we turn to for the Cubs fan jam is Matt Klein. Matt, of course, did wonders for us. He went to Pittsburgh for that wild card. He went to St. Louis for the games. And here he is now covering the Chicago Bulls for us and the Bulls fan jam. Matt, good to talk to you.
What's up, brother? Good to talk to you.
So you watched tonight's game. You watched the game so we didn't have to. You watched the full Chicago Bulls-San Antonio Spurs game.
Yeah, I tell you what, it was a pretty remarkable game, too.
We gave you a good one.
Well, yeah, no, it was great. You know, there was never a point in this game where anybody had a double-digit lead, which is very rare for the NBA. You know, it's just a streaky game. People go back and forth, up and down. This thing was tight throughout, which you very seldom see in an NBA game. So that was special.
And that's very, I mean, it's true. Like even with the Golden State Warriors who were losing last I checked, but that changed. They're like the Chicago Bulls from the late 90s where they just go down 20 points in the first half. And then they come, right. then they come running back and you're like, oh, this is so, I don't know, so predictable in a way.
Yeah, and then, like, Steph Curry's got ice on his knees for the last, like, 9 minutes of the game. You know, like, they pulled away so much, you know, by that point. Yeah, it is predictable in that sense, and it makes it very annoying, and that's what made tonight. I'm not kidding. It was very, almost like a, you know, playoff atmosphere. Yeah, the United Center is great when they get close games. You know, it really is. The fans are outstanding.
And Noah gets to do his thing, and Rose gets to do it. Like, they play to that stuff.
By the way, Noah looks incredible tonight, like vintage Noah all over the floor. You know, the balanced game where he finishes like one board or one assist shy of a triple-double. You know, he was I don't have his stat line in front of me, but I think he was very close to double digits in points, boards, and assists. So, and he was just all over the place.
Would that be – I mean, if I ask you the questions for the Bulls fan jam, which are, you know, like just to give the rules to the Cubs fan jam, it was always – it was more about the experience of watching the game than who won, who lost,
right.
who was the best player, who was not.
Right.
But if I said what was the stat of the game that sort of stood out to you? Was it that Noah played well?
Noah playing well was definitely huge. I'll tell you a stat that jumped out to me, and it doesn't reflect the fact that we actually won the game, but it kind of paints the picture as far as where Derrick Rose is, whether you want to say in his recovery or just the player that he has now become after all these injuries. He did not shoot his first free throws, and he played a vast majority of this game. He did not shoot his first free throws until there was 3 minutes left in the game.
Wow.
And you know, this is the guy that used to slash to the hole, get to the paint, you know, and he'd either create some sort of acrobatic layup or dunk, or he'd at least be going to the line.
Right.
He did not shoot a free throw. It's something. He didn't shoot a free throw until 3 minutes.
You know, I haven't watched much Bulls this year just because we're on when they're on, but the games I have watched, I've watched Derrick Rose continue that style. And I've watched him come up empty with calls. Like, it seems like he goes to the hole, and then they're just like, well, he missed a layup. Like, and he's looking
Agreed.
For the call. Yeah.
I agree that he has definitely shown many of those, like, flashes of, you know, acceleration, explosiveness, if you will. But he, he's just not getting those calls. But I also think that he used to be able to get to a certain level, like above the rim, that he doesn't get to now. You know, there's, you know, one of the questions we were gonna cover was with the best layup that should have been a dunk.
Right. And that's coming up.
That's every time Derrick Rose was like going to the hole. I mean, he was constantly laying everything in on certain plays where you know in the past you remember it being some thunderous dunk.
Right.
You know,
he doesn't do that two-hand jam anymore.
Do it anymore. Yeah, exactly.
Who's the dunker on the Bulls? Is it Jimmy Butler?
Taj Gibson? Taj always does his little, you know, over-dramatic, you know, put-back dunks. You know, the king of the cherry pick, Taji. But, no, I mean, he's great. I love Taj Gibson.
But you're right. He gets the rebound, and it could be an easy put-back, and he emphatically dunks it.
We could be down 14, and he's just like screaming all the way down the court.
Yeah,
you know. But hey, that's what gets us.
But I guess Jimmy Butler is a Mirotic. He doesn't dunk. Who dunks on this team? Nah. You need some highlight dunks. And who's the highlight dunk guy?
That's a great question. Probably Jimmy. You know, and even he doesn't. Yeah, it's not very flashy. I wouldn't say we really have a flashy dunker. I think this Portis, this rookie, if we can ever get him on the court, our first round pick, he's going to be fun to watch. But we just kind of have a log jam at the four and the five, so we can't really squeeze him in there.
Let me ask you this one: who gets the award for best complainer of the night? That's my favorite thing. It's now in the NBA. Every NBA game has to have that one guy who, it seems like every time they go back and forth and they don't get a call, the players are complaining.
Yes. The Spurs actually don't. The players themselves are very well disciplined and don't really complain much. Ginobili kind of annoys me sometimes with the facial expressions. That guy's always annoyed me his whole career. You know, I maybe it's the fact that I'm jealous that this guy with a bald spot and a 5-inch vertical is like still just like a mean baller out there on the court. But you know, I would have to say Popovich. You know, Popovich, he's of that, you know, Belichick and you know, Phil Jackson mold, where they just know that if you just keep breaking down and working the officials, things are going to go your way.
They're going to go your way, yeah. Does Hoiberg do that? Because Thibodeau used to do that all the time.
Thibodeau was also very active on the sidelines. Hoiberg is very good at sitting. He doesn't he doesn't get up much. He's not very animated when he's out there. That might come in time, but he spends a lot of time just sitting down.
All right, let me ask you another. What was I mean, you watched the game. I mentioned it earlier. You didn't have the Comcast feed, right?
No, so I did.
Oh, you did? Okay, good.
On NBA TV, they carried the Bulls audio. And I'm assuming you're going to ask me about Stacey King right now.
Yeah, right. What was the best Stacey King-ism of the night?
Nothing. I mean, the guy brought nothing tonight.
Oh.
And I hate to let you down. I mean, yeah, he did his typical, you know, beep, beep. He made some comment, and Rose was complaining about having double vision. And Stacey King said, well, you know, hey, Derek, just shoot for the small one. But I don't know what that means. Like, I thought he had an opportunity there to say something funny. But he didn't, you know, he didn't really come through.
Yeah, you'd think with the Spurs in town, he'd be like, this is a huge platform for me. I got to come up with three new ones.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, and even with NBA TV picking up the club, I mean, there was nothing, you know, obviously everybody drive home safe, beep, beep, all that stuff, you know, like the typical Stacey King.
He's just going back to it. So you're essentially telling us he phoned it in tonight.
He phoned it in tonight, yeah. He had a very subpar showing for his nationally televised game.
There should be a stat line that's like, you know, Butler 14-10, like and then Stacey King, how he did, he got a 7 out of 10. You know, that kind of thing.
I'll tell you one thing. These Spurs, though, are pretty incredible. I was looking back on it because I was in my head. I was trying to compare them to the kind of the Patriots, you know, and, you know, like Belichick and Brady, you know, versus like Popovich and Duncan. And Belichick and Brady have been to 9 AFC championship games together. Wow. Can you imagine if we had a coach quarterback combo and went to 9 NFC championship games? But Duncan and Pop have also been to 9 Western Conference finals and have won 5 titles. And then obviously the Patriots have their 4, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, you know, it's just juggernaut. I mean, these guys are unbelievable.
Mack Line, You did it. You nailed it. You gave us a good Bulls fan jam, and we appreciate it as always. Thank you, buddy.
You got it, brother. Hey, quickly, happy birthday to Jill Glow.
Yes, that's right.
Jill Glow Kaufman, however we're saying it these days. Jill Glowman, whatever we want to call it.
Yes, happy birthday, so, Jill. Yes. Good way to get that in.
We had to get that in, right?
There you go. Matt, thank you, buddy.
You got it.
There's live radio for you. Rob Martyr in the middle of the cast. We're waiting on that field goal.
All we need is John Facenda right now.
It's amazing. I can't even tell. I don't have the audio on. I just have the screen up here, and it just, I don't even know what's happening in this game. But a good game to end the week in the NFL, I guess. And the Ravens beat the Browns on a blocked kick returned for a touchdown. Wow. That's a good way to end it. That'll do
it. Just in one of the most exciting yet unscripted plays in professional football was made in Cleveland. A blocked field goal attempt returned 133 yards.
You know when it's the
for a touchdown.
When the post game interview of the Browns and the Ravens is the guy who blocked, who ran the kickback, who's one of the special team guys. You know you just don't have any stars. There's just no stars on this team. All right, moving on. Well, let's get to the stars in Chicago, because the big stars took the stage this weekend, this Thanksgiving weekend. The high school football champions played out, and in the 4A division, Phillips beat up on Belleville 51-7 to become the first public league team to win a state championship in history. Wendell Phillips Academy is located in the heart of the south side of Chicago in the Bronzeville neighborhood. Coach Troy McAllister joins me on the line. Coach McAllister, congratulations.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
So, I mean, looking, it's been a couple days now. I mean, you get back to school today. Tell me a little bit, how does it feel to be the first state champion in Chicago history?
You know, it took a little while to kind of sink in. And then today, with the amount of media and the following and everything, it's kind of really starting to sink in that we kind of made history Friday night.
Do the players know that? Do the kids that that played on this team and won this game on was it Friday? Did they know what they accomplished?
Yeah, I really think they're starting to see it. Last year, you know, we made the state championship game and lost, and there was a big following, and they really took it to heart. You know what they lost last year. This year, they came back, and they were really mentally prepared to go the distance, and I think they knew at the end, you know, what this meant, and just the looks on their faces, the faces, the sheer joy and excitement, that was the one thing I will always remember.
You know, Pete and I were talking earlier in the show just about how curious it is that the public league has never won a state championship. In your estimation, why is that? Because it seems like you've been at the helm of the Phillips program now, and there's always been exciting and tremendous athletes to come out of the public league. Why hasn't the public league been able to, up to this point, up to this weekend, win a state championship?
You know, there's two main reasons that I see. One is the lack of resources. You know, you go to these suburban and Catholic school teams, they have their own stadiums. They have all the equipment necessary. The majority of the public league teams are traveling to Gately or Hanson or some of the other CPS games to play. It's tough to find places to practice. And the second, I find it comes down to coaching, and not so much the quality of coaching, but sometimes the quantity. In CPS, we have 5 stipends for coaches. You know, you get up to the suburban programs, and there's 10 to 14 stipends for coaches. That does make a significant difference.
For you with Phillips, what was it? I mean, when you talk about some of those hurdles that you have to get over, to some of the hurdles that the other teams don't, practice fields, travel, equipment, resources, what was it about the Phillips team that made you overcome those obstacles and win a championship?
We weren't afraid to address things with our team. You know, our young men walk 3/4 of a mile every day to practice. They accepted it. They knew, hey, we don't have everything we want, but that doesn't mean we can't be successful. And they really bought into the message we were trying to send. And, you know, and each and every week we bring in a game plan. They come in, they learn it, and they go about it.
for you, when you were, when you know, coaching last year's team and this year's team, going all the way to the state championship, what were some of the messages you were sending to these young men? I mean, for you, how did you relate to the players to get them ready for the glory that they're involved in now?
Since last year's game, our message has been unfinished business, and it was 365 days of don't let this happen again. And that message really struck deep with our young men. The whole off season was the best buy-in we've ever had in our weight training program and with our track team. And when the season started this year, they were ready to roll.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard to get players, high school kids, to engage in that kind of sustained mission, sustained drive to something? I mean, the goal is from 1 year to, you know, and you talked about buy-in on the weight program, you talk about the off season. I mean, a lot of that's volunteer. How do you get the kids to buy in?
It's difficult. You know, this is our sixth year with the program. You know, and the first couple of years there was a struggle with that. And it's really up until the last 2 years that we've really got the full buy-in. You know, obviously winning covers up a lot of things and takes care of some things, but, you know, ultimately it's just the young men and them buying in. And we have a great group of seniors, and this is the 1 year where I feel very confident. They've shown, you know, all the underclassmen what it means to be a Wildcat or what it takes to be a part of our program.
It really is a feel-good story, and you hear, I mean, I even said it early in the show, and people are talking about it. With everything that's happening in Chicago and all the things that are happening on the south side of Chicago, for these kids to accomplish not only, you know, playing at a competitive level, but going down or going to, I keep saying down, but I guess to DeKalb now, to win a state championship, it has to be special.
Yeah, no question. With everything that occurred last week, we sat down with the team and talked to them. And in particular, I had a few extra conversations with our captains. And they were so amazing about everything. They understood, and I said it wasn't fair that people were going to try to use them to kind of be a part of a healing process. But they understood the magnitude of it, and they really did embrace it, and I think it gave them a little more motivation to succeed.
Okay, final question for you, Coach. You going to miss these kids?
Yeah, there's no question. This is, you know, this is the best group we've ever had, and it's a group of young men. It's the character, first and foremost. But, you know, you just think of the memories, the laughter, and everything these young men have been through. Our middle linebacker, you know, tore his PCL in the middle of the year. He's our best player. He's out for the season. And when he was up on stage and he got the trophy, his face was absolutely priceless. It meant so much to him, even though he didn't play in the game, but it meant the world to him. And that's just a testament to the young men on the team and their families, and definitely going to miss these guys.
Coach Troy McAllister, he coached a 4A division champ, Phillips Wildcats, the Wendell Phillips Academy Wildcats, located on the south side of Chicago in Bronzeville. Coach McAllister, thanks for taking some time out tonight.
Thank you very much.
And congrats.
Thanks.
Great show tonight. How great is that, Coach McAllister, to be on the program with us the Monday back to be back at the school to bring Wendell Phillips Academy a state championship, the first in public league history. Now, Phillips, he said 6 years of the program, so it's not like a Julian High School, you know, it's been around for 100 years, mm-hmm. You know, it's a turnaround school, but amazing that they were able to do that. And he nailed it. The two things I thought were so interesting about that. One, the fact that resources are just part of it. It's not, you know, like we talked about, like in Rocky IV with computers and needles. But it has to do with the fact that they have their own, you know, suburban high schools have their own field, their own practice field, their own stadium, their own boosters, everything down the line that you just take for granted when it comes to high school football.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you watch Friday Night Lights, you know. I mean, I know Texas football is huge, but, yeah, they have, like, a stadium that a college plays in. They have, like, right. you know, 35 they have quarterback coaches. When I was talked about earlier, seeing Sullivan High School playing practicing up near my house, there was probably three coaches there.
I mean, I don't even know how you do that, how you coach a football team with 3 to 4 coaches. I mean, you're right. Some of the big ones you think about, I don't know what the numbers are for, say, a Wheaton or, some of the bigger program, Mount Carmel, that kind of thing. But you would think there'd be more than 3 or 4. I mean, that's 3 or 4 adults. What do you do at that point? Do you have volunteers to make sure the other stuff sort of, I guess that's what you do, right?
I mean, I think I even had, I had like 6 or 7 just in my grammar school.
You were a grammar school football player?
Yeah.
What was your nickname? Do you have a nickname?
Zippy.
Let's go 34 route, B on 3. I'm going to hit you on the post, Zippy. Were you any good?
That was all right.
What'd you play?
Played a little linebacker.
Punter? Oh, I was going to guess.
Sorry. You say punter?
I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything.
I said punter.
The linebacker, huh? So you were like
I was a tall kid.
You were kind of like Morrissey? What was that guy? Jim Morrissey, the number 51?
Yeah, Jim Morrissey.
You were like a Morrissey.
Yeah. Shane McClellan.
You're McClellan type. You're Urlacher type? Or that's just freakish of nature?
Yeah.
That you're more like a, like I'm trying to think of good like steady white linebackers. Like the Vikings had a couple in the middle of the 80s. Had always had blood on their pads.
What about the steel curtain head, Jack Lambert and Jack
Ham? You fancy yourself as a Jack Lambert, Pete Zimmerman?
I played 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and I went in 6th grade I was like in the back row of the team. 7th row, 7th grade I was in the middle. By 8th grade,
they outgrew you.
Down to the front, holding
the
football.
Did you play high school?
I played high school as well.
You did?
Yeah, not really that good.
So were you the kind of guy that, like, when there was a blowout in the fourth quarter, they're like, let's give Zippy a chance? And then all the guys on the sideline, like, we went to a high grade school with Zippy, go get him! And it became like a charity case. Were you that guy?
That sounds vaguely familiar.
That's great. Hey, everybody, look, stop what you're doing. Zippy's in. And then maybe you ran the wrong way.
No. Oh, come on.
Come on. You became a viral. If there was an internet, you'd have a viral hit on your
right.
Hands.
Yeah. How about that? Missed out.
No, I'm sure you were good. I'm being facetious. Zippy sounds like a winner nickname. So. Anyway, it was great to have Coach. The other thing that was interesting is about how a lot of people were going to use the Phillips team to almost be a conduit to a good feel-good story for the south side of Chicago as opposed to what's happening now. That's interesting, too, because you don't think about, like, seniors in high school having to take on that burden. They're not athletes, paid athletes. They're seniors in high school. They don't need the media. There's probably media frenzy putting mics in their faces today talking about, what's it mean? And they're like, we won a football game. Like, I don't know. So it's interesting that had to have conversations with his captains about that. I think that's a noble thing, an interesting way to look at football in Chicago, when you think about it, So congrats to Phillips and congrats to the Public League in Chicago for the first ever state championship at IHSA. Well, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Thanks to Pete Zimmerman. Thanks to Rob Martier, Eric Solomon, Roger Badish, everybody else who contributed to the download tonight. Javi Javavola. I know Sandy Marshall loves, actor Sandy Marshall loves Javi Javavola, so you have that too. We're stepping aside tomorrow night as the Blackhawks return home at the United Center to take on Minnesota, but we will be back on Wednesday with another great show. Patty Vasquez is up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez here.